Okay, let's open our Bibles to a passage I read from 1 Samuel chapter 30. You'll see on the sheet we're going to look at verse 7 to the end of the book. So last time we left David strengthening himself in the Lord his God, encouraging himself in God. He and his men have discovered how unpredictable life can be. They come back to Ziklag and found it burnt to the ground, and their wives and their children have been taken away captives. And these weary men who've been marching for 6 days at least, they've gone three days with the Philistine army, you remember, and then they're sent back another 3 days, and they're weary and they're looking forward to seeing their families, no doubt, and they arrive back to this scene and we're told that they weep until they have no more strength to weep. They're broken then, including David's. And then David finds out not only that circumstances are unpredictable, he finds out, doesn't he, that men are unpredictable as well. Because his men, having stopped crying, begin to grumble and complain and turn on him and talk about stoning him. And so what does David do? Well, he turns to the one great certainty in life, the one sure thing in life, the one thing that isn't unpredictable. He turns to his God and he finds his strength in God. He reminds himself of the truths of God and the promises of God and his hope in God. And there he finds security. And we reminded ourselves, that is our need, isn't it? Not just in the big moments of life, but in everyday life. That every day we need to go to our God and find strength in him and encourage ourselves in him. We need to open his word. We need to remind ourselves of his promises and his truths and the gospel and find our strength in this unpredictable world in him. So some of you are going through difficult circumstances and unpredictable times and the future's unsure. Well, that's true for all of us, isn't it? Some of us may feel it more, but it's true for us all, and we need our God, and we need to look to him and rest in him and find our strength in him. Well, that's where we left David last time, and it was a good thing, wasn't it? Because David had been through a pretty bleak time up until that point. He'd been living in Ziklag. He'd been living a lie, hadn't he? And he'd been talking to himself, you remember, back in the beginning of chapter 27, in a bad way. I'm going to perish by the hand of Saul. There's nothing for me to do but to flee to the land of the Philistines. And so at least this brought him back, didn't it? Brought him to his senses in many ways. Well, we're going to look this evening at the rest of this chapter and the last chapter as well. Of course, we're going to continue into 2 Samuel to look further at the life of David. I'm away for the next couple of weeks. I haven't planned it very well. This week's holiday, and then the following week I'm preaching away. But then we'll come back to it and look at God's ongoing purposes. But I want us to see 4 things this evening. You'll see them there on the sheet. We see in this chapter the Lord's sovereignty, the Lord's salvation, the Lord's servant, and then the Lord's sentence. So let's think about those together. The Lord's sovereignty. How often do we come back to this, but how often do we need to come back to this? This is verses 7 to 15. We're faced with the overruling of our gods in the affairs of life. So we mustn't forget that we're let in on information at the beginning of this chapter that David and his men don't have the privilege of knowing. So we're told, aren't we, in the beginning, that a band of roaming Amalekites have come and they've done this to Ziklag. But there's no indication in the text that David and his men know that. You know, these people don't leave a note saying, you know, nailed to a tree, saying, by the way, this was the Amalekites and we're planning to stay here if you fancy chasing us. They don't do that, do they? They just do what they do and they leave. And all that David has is in verse 7 and 8, you remember, that assurance from God that if they set out and pursue these people, they will overtake them and they will recover what they've lost. And it's with that assurance that David and his men set out. But think about it. They don't know where they're going. They don't know who they're going after. They've got no information at all. And worse than that, these men are shattered, as I've said. They've been on the march for at least 6 days. They've marched with the Philistines. When the Philistines had said, Well, some of them had said, hang on a minute, we're not having David go to battle with us. They've marched 3 days back, well over 120 miles. I don't know when the last time any of you marched 120 miles. Looking at you, not quite a long time ago. They're going to be shattered, aren't they? Indeed, 200 of the men are so shattered that when they get to the brook Besor, they can't go on. They can't take a step further. They're left behind. So things are not very promising, are they? They're not very hopeful. It's not going to take much longer before these men just go, we can't do this anymore. We're going to give up. And then there's a turning point, isn't there? In verse 11. They stumble across an Egyptian slave in a field. That was lucky, wasn't it? I mean, no doubt it would have been very easy to miss him, wouldn't it? Or for it not to have seen him, or not to even have gone through that particular field. But they do, and they discover this man. And they reach him just in time as well. Did you notice that? He's sick. Verse 12 tells us he's not eaten food or drunk anything for 3 days. A little while later, he would have been dead. So they find him just in time. I mean, that's lucky as well, isn't it? And then he just happens to be a slave of the Amalekites, who've just raided. Not only that, but he happens to be a slave who's overheard or known in some way where they're going to have their camp. And so after reviving him and promising not to kill him if they take him to the camp, they know where they're going and they know who's raided. And it's, I'm glad you smile, because it's not luck at all, is it? It's not just good fortune. It's another reminder of the wonderful providence of God's overruling hand of God. It's just a small thing. It's just a minor detail, but God's in it. Stumbling across a dying Egyptian, but it's a turning point in the story. And it leads to the saving of all the wives and all the children of these men. We're reminded that, as one of the commentators put it, little providences make a big difference. Little details make a big difference. Why has this man been left behind? Oh, he was sick. And his master, he's obviously not a very nice master, had gone, well, yeah, I'm sorry, mate. Yeah, we're going. You're on your own. What does that mean? It means this, doesn't it? That God had caused this tiny unseen bug, whatever it was that made this man sick. He was in control of that. He was sovereign over that. It's a little detail. It's an unseen thing, but God's in it. So this man is in the field sick. David and his men happen to come across him. It's all part of God's sovereign purposes. And we're reminded, aren't we, of the wisdom and the care of our sovereign God. I mean, surely we could go around this room tonight, couldn't we? And we could all tell, I'm no doubt about it, stories of where just some small little seemingly insignificant thing has been overruled by the Lord in some wonderful way in our lives. I've told you before, an accident, somebody phoning me by accident led to me marrying Lois. The principal of London Theological Seminary just decided to, I mean, this is an unfortunate providence for you, but decided to, when he got a letter from Great Anningham Baptist Church, from Alfred Grimsey, and probably written in green, that, those of you who remember Alfred, can you send somebody to this, to Great Anningham for a Sunday? And he said, oh, we'll send Hugh. That's just a couple of mine, but we could all talk about providences, couldn't we? Details, minor little things that seem so small, and yet God's hand is in it. From small little providences make a big difference. How amazing our God is. All things work together for good. Everything's in his hand. I don't imagine this man felt very good when he was sick and ill and lying there on the third day and he hasn't had anything to eat or drink, but the God's got a purpose even in that. So even in your trials and troubles at the moment that you're going through, the Lord is in it. The Lord's sovereignty. Brothers and sisters, that's where we rest. That's where peace is found. That's where contentment's found, isn't it? Resting trusting. It's often in just little things, isn't it? Not in the trumpets don't blow and the sky doesn't go back, but just in the little details of life. The Lord's sovereignty. Secondly, the Lord's salvation. That's verse 16 to 20. You know, it's one thing being led to the Amalekite camp. There's still the small detail of still having to defeat them, isn't there? I mean, that's not a minor detail. So they arrive at the camp at twilight, and they have a distinct advantage, don't they, that all the Amalekites are in party mode. They're rejoicing in their victory. They're drunk, and they're dancing. And you see, now it's going to be the Amalekites who are going to turn up to discover how unpredictable life is. Suddenly, in the midst of all their celebrations, they're attacked by David and his men. And they're attacked from twilight until the evening of the next day. This is quite some battle. It lasts all night and all the next day. The second part of verse 17 has always struck me as quite a surprising piece of information. And I told you, it's that interesting little comment, aren't we? Not a man of them escaped, except for 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. And you think, why are we told that detail? Well, we don't know a lot about it, do we? But it certainly tells us something, doesn't it? How many men did David have? He had 400 men, didn't he? Extremely weary men. And yet those words make clear that these 400 men who escape are clearly a tiny part of the Amalekite. You know, it's clearly not 450 Amalekites, are there? Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And none of them escaped except for 400. I mean, that tells us there's going to be a few thousand, at least, isn't there? I mean, we're told they're spread out over the area. So this is a mighty victory, David and his men are given. This is a tiny force overwhelming an army far, far greater than itself. And it's not simply that they sort of dash in, grab their wives and children, dash back out again. No. This is a rout. They are defeated. They got back everything, and indeed they take spoils for themselves. And the writer wants us to realize just how complete the victory was. Look at verse 19. And nothing of theirs was lacking, neither small nor great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. And David did it. But we see in verse 23 that David is quite clear who's given them the victory. You see verse 23? My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. So did David and his men fight? Of course they fought. Did they fight hard? Of course they did. Did they use their skills that God had given them in battle? Of course they did. But who gave them the victory? The Lord did. The Lord did. You've got human responsibility and human action. David and his men, but ultimately it was the Lord who gave them the victory. Says so. David says so. And David, this is a case of salvation is of the Lord. This was the Lord's victory, the Lord's doing, and he's shown once again to be far stronger than his enemies, able even to use a handful of people to defeat a vast army. And we see that time and time again in the Word of God, don't we? A little bit later on in the life of Israel, there'll be a king called Asa. You remember, he was faced with an army of 1 million Ethiopians with 300 chariots and an army twice the size of his own army. And yet before the battle, he would pray, wouldn't he? Lord, it is nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power. God, our God is not a God who needs a certain number of people to work. He can fulfill his purposes through the weakest, through the nobodies. He can deliver by himself. He can use our feeble resources. And it's encouraging, isn't it, tonight, that our God is a saving God. He's a God of salvation. He saves and delivers. And we're reminded also, aren't we, that our lives are in the Lord's hands. Not one of the women or children were lost. Not one of the men in battle. It's the Lord who gives and and takes life, isn't it? And we're in his hands. And as we'll see in a while, on another battlefield, the same day, probably, many Israelites are falling by the swords in the purposes of God. But not on this battlefield. Not a single shaft can hit. We often sing, don't we? Till the God of love sees fit. We're in his hands. The God of our salvation. But God promises this salvation, doesn't he? Back in verse, this rescue, back in verse 8. Of the chapter when David inquires, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? Pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all. This is a promise rescue and God delivers. And we think about great David's greatest son and the promise that he will come and he will deliver, not from the Amalekites, but from sin and death and hell, triumph in the grave and over the grave. And that is exactly what he does in the gospel. We have a God who saves, who delivers, and who calls us to come and trust in him tonight. So we've got the Lord's sovereignty, and we've got the Lord's salvation. And thirdly, we've got the Lord's servant. That's verses 21 to 22. To 31. I want to just notice, I think the writer wants us to notice the graciousness of David in dealing with these 200 men who had been left behind because they're too weary to carry on. The writer focuses on that in those verses. Now, we've already seen, haven't we, how fickle David's men were earlier on in the chapter when they turn on David, but we see it again here, don't we? So 400 men return from the battlefield, and at least a good number of them decide they don't want to share the spoil with these 200. I mean, they weren't involved in the victory. They didn't put their lives on the line. They didn't fight. Why should they have anything? Well, give them their wives and their children, but that's all that they deserve. And that's what they say, don't they, in verse 22. But what are we told about those people at the beginning of verse 22? Do you see? Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David. And there's this contrast, isn't there, then, with David's. David's attitude towards these others is very different. And the reason it's different is because he's aware, as we've seen, of where this victory came from. In verse 23, let me read verse 23 again. But David said, this is David responding to these people saying, well, they don't deserve anything. David says, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. So he's aware, isn't he, that this spoil, it's not spoil that they've earned. It's been given to them by the Lord. It was the Lord who brought them back alive. It was the Lord who given them victory. It's the Lord who delivered their enemies into their hands. And there's no grounds, as far as David's concerned, for pride and for looking down at others, for thinking, well, they don't deserve anything. No, David is profoundly aware of the grace of God and the goodness of God and the deliverance of God. And it's not hard to apply that then to ourselves. That's our attitude as believers. That's to be our attitude as believers, isn't it? And it's easy for us, if we're not careful, to look down on others. So we think, oh, they haven't done as much as us. They don't know as much as us. And they haven't got the gifts that I've got. But if we understand grace, if we understand that all that we have comes from the Lord, our salvation comes from the Lord, our gifts come from the Lord, our strength comes from the Lord, then that will rid us of that looking down on others and thinking we're better than others, thinking we deserve more than others, more recognition than others, perhaps, whatever it might be. We need to understand grace more, don't we? We need to understand the gospel. We understand that everything we have, every gift has come from the Lord. What do we have that what have we got that we haven't received, says Paul. And that should be our attitude with all that we have, with our possessions and everything as well. It's very easy to hold on to things and say, well, I earned this. This is mine. I can do with this what I like. It's up to me. I can keep it for myself. Whereas really, if we're Christians, we should be saying, well, this is the Lord's grace that I have this money. He gave me the strength to do the work that I do. He gives me my help and a health. This is the Lord's. But then also David's gracious attitude towards these other men came also, didn't it, from an understanding that every person has a part to play. Let me just read verse 24 and verse 25 again. Look at verse 24 and 25. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. So it was, from that day forward, he made a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. So David was aware that to have men who will stay behind to look after the supplies is just as important as having men on the front. These 200 men, yeah, they were too weary to carry on, but they did have a job to do. They had to look after the supplies. I mean, you know, if they just left them, anyone could take them. So there was a job for them to do, wasn't there? And we know we have that same attitude, aren't we, with the church? The picture of the body makes that clear, doesn't it? The church being a body. So some parts are obvious, some parts are visible. Other parts, you know, are not clear and not so visible, but every part's needed. So some of you say to me, all I can do now is pray. Well, that's a vital, vital, vital part of the work, isn't it? And every part's needed. And whatever we're doing, we need those behind us who are praying for us, who are doing so many other things as well. There's no grounds, is there, for despising anyone else in the church. No grounds for looking down our noses, thinking they don't matter. We could do without them if they don't turn up. If they weren't here, it wouldn't matter. Everybody is needed. Everyone has a role to play. Great, David's graciousness is also seen, isn't it? And wisdom, really. He doesn't keep the spoils to himself and to his men. He sends them out, doesn't he? Well, that was the last part of the chapter with all those names. He sends some of the spoils. Even though he's been out of Judah for some time, he's still thinking of his brothers and in different places, and he sends gifts to them. Now, of course, that is going to help him, isn't it? When he in a little while's time, when he's seeking to get the throne, and that's here we see his heart. He's thinking of his brothers. He's caring for others. And we can apply that, can't we? And we can say, well, we've got to look after each other, we've got to care for each other, and yet we've got to think further afield as well to our brothers and sisters in other places too. So the Lord's servant, there's a what's shaping David? What's shaping his decisions? What's shaping his actions? It's an awareness that everything he has comes from the Lord. The Lord's given us the victory. The Lord's given us these things. And so I'm saying, brothers and sisters, that's what's got to shape us. That all that we have comes from the Lord. One last thing. And we've got the Lord's sentence. That's into chapter 31. I think it's helpful to realize these two battles are being fought simultaneously. So by the time David and his men have done that journey back to Ziklag and then have gone out and discovered and found the Amalekites, the Philistines have reached the battlefield and are fighting against Israel. And the writer sort of hurries us, doesn't he? I mean, the chapter divisions weren't in the original, of course, and he's hurrying us from one battlefield to another. So chapter 31 begins, now the Philistines fought against Israel. And I think we're presented, aren't we, with one last contrast between these two men. We've seen it, haven't we, as we've gone through, that just the contrast between David and Saul. And we've got it one more time here, haven't we? In chapter 30, we see the Lord give David and his men this great victory. Not one of them's lost. And chapter 31 couldn't be more different, could it? It's a scene of great loss. It records the death of many of the men of Israel, the death of Saul's sons, the death of Saul himself along with his armor bearer. It's sort of one last tragic scene in this tragic life of Saul. It's a tragic chapter in many ways. And surely it's with sadness particularly that we notice the death of Jonathan in verse 2. I mean, what an amazing character Jonathan's been. He's one of the favorites, isn't he? The way he's been with David, the friendship he's shown, the loyalty he's shown. The way he's come to David, hasn't he, and strengthened his hand in God in David's toughest times. And in a sense, it's tragic, and yet in a sense, it's a wonderful picture of a faith, someone who's faithful to the end. Let me just quote Dale Ralph Davis, one of the great commentator on the Old Testament books. This is what he wrote. Here is Jonathan's obituary. He remained a true friend to David and a faithful son to Saul. He surrendered his kingship to David. He sacrificed his life for Saul. Maybe it's not tragic at all. What is tragic about remaining faithfully in the calling God has assigned us? Was it tragic when Jonathan laid aside a kingdom he could not have to enter a kingdom he could not lose? Well, that's what he does, isn't he? God's given the kingdom to David. Jonathan's never going to be the king, but he gladly surrenders that, doesn't he? And trusts the Lord and gains a kingdom that he can't ever lose. And there's such a contrast, isn't there, in this chapter between the end of Jonathan and the end of Saul. One dies with great hope. One takes his own life in hopelessness. And this chapter records the death of Saul. Then he's critically injured, isn't he? He calls for his armor bearer to kill him. His armor bearer won't kill him. And so he takes his own life. He falls on his own sword and finishes himself off in that way. Why does Saul die like this? Well, in the end, it's the judgment of God. It's a sentence of God on him, isn't it? I mean, just back in chapter 28 and verse 19, there, in that strange episode where Saul summons up through the medium Samuel, we're told, aren't we? Moreover, in verse 19, moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. In other words, will die. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. But that, of course, had been spoken of right back. If you go back to chapter 15 and verse 26. Chapter 15 and verse 26. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. So that's what it goes back to. It goes back to his rejection of the word of God. In fact, if you just go on with me to 1 Chronicles chapter 10. You just turn there with me. We're nearly done. 1 Chronicles chapter 10 and verse 13 and 14, where it's put in really stark terms. 1 Chronicles 10 verse 13. So Saul died for his unfaithfulness with which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. He did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore, he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. This is the Lord's sentence on him. This is the Lord's judgment on him for his disobedience, for not heeding the word of the Lord. What a tragedy. What a tragedy. What a tragic life. And even the last few verses, go back to our chapter, even the last few verses remind us, in a sense, of how tragic it is. Because we're given the gruesome details, aren't we, in the last part of the chapter, of how the Philistines cut off the head of Saul and send his armor back to the temple of the Ashtoreth and fasten his body to the wall of Beth Shan. And then we read in verse 11, now when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard that the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and traveled all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth-shan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. And we think, why did the people of Jabesh-Gilead risk that? Why did they do that? Why did they mourn for Saul for 7 days? Well, because of those events back in chapter 11. Do you remember? We started later than this in 1 Samuel because we're dealing with David, but we have mentioned this. Back in chapter 11, Saul had saved Jabesh-Gilead. In those heady, optimistic days at the beginning, when the Spirit of the Lord has come on Saul and everything seems good and promising and he's delivered them. And yet, in a sense, that makes it even more tragic, doesn't it? Because those promising beginning has just ended in such a tragic way. So it's a reminder to us all tonight, believer or unbeliever, of the seriousness with which we must take God's word and the seriousness of dismissing God's words and disobedience to God's word. It should humble us and cause us to cast ourselves again upon the Lord, asking for his help, asking for his mercy, asking for his grace. In the beginning of 2 Samuel, we'll come back to a little bit what David has to say about the death of Jonathan and the death of Saul. But 1 Samuel leaves us with this reminder of the seriousness, the wonder of being able to rest in God's sovereignty, but the seriousness of despising God's words. And we need to live in the light of that and pray that God will write his word on our hearts.